Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet, and I'm in Edinburgh. As always, I'm with my peripatetic co-host, Frank Cogliano. Frank, where are you this morning?
Good morning, David. I'm in Burbank, California. I just landed at Bob Hope Airport yesterday.
Are you going to be on The Price is Right and get a California Emissions car while they still allow that to happen?
Yeah, it's nice and sunny here.
All right, well, it's nice and overcast and cloudy like it often is in Scotland in mid-March. But three topics for today. Last week we looked at Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson. This week we're going to look at Donald Trump and Richard Nixon, another comparison that's often made in the media. Topic number two, we're going to look at impeachment and show the mechanics of impeachment. Lots of people are talking about a potential Trump impeachment. We're going to talk about the twice in the past that's actually a president's been impeached, although not convicted, and the one time a person was almost impeached. And third, did Ben Carson fail American history? A recent article in The New Yorker by Jelani Cobb looks at Ben Carson and Betsy DeVos and the ways in which certain figures in the Trump administration have a very peculiar understanding of history and African-American history in particular. All right, so Frank, last week we talked about Trump and Andrew Jackson, and we looked at a Mark Cheatham article that said they weren't all that similar, and I think we both broadly agreed with that. The other president that Trump gets compared to a lot is Richard Nixon. I was curious what you thought about that comparison.
Yeah, thanks, David. There's been a lot of Trump-Nixon talk, I think, on social media, or buzz on social media in the past few weeks. In many respects, I think this is a better analogy, certainly, than the Andrew Jackson analogy. I guess, in trying to think about this and the two analogies that have been made, I think Trump's admirers have tried to, including Trump himself, have sought to compare him to Andrew Jackson. And as we discussed last week, it's a rather old-fashioned and particular version of Andrew Jackson. Whereas his critics are more prone to compare him to Nixon. There are, as with the Andrew Jackson comparison, some quite powerful, superficial similarities. They're both very, very thin-skinned. They both seem to have a somewhat callous and casual relationship with the law and the Constitution when it comes to achieving their own ends or pursuing their own ends.
They're both pretty paranoid.
Yeah, both pretty paranoid. They both see the press as enemies. They both keep track of who their enemies are. I mean, there are real similarities in terms of personality, I think. There are some crucial differences. Richard Nixon, for all his flaws, was an intelligent man. He was fairly well experienced. He had a very good track record of public service prior to becoming president, being elected in 1968 and inaugurated in 69. He'd been vice president for two terms, for example. He'd served in Congress. I mean, Nixon had a long record of, not always distinguished, but a long record of public service.
I think he had even argued some cases before the Supreme Court as a lawyer. So, I mean, somebody who, you know, had a lifetime of being part of government.
That's right. Now, I think one of the similarities, when they ran for office, you know, Nixon's Southern strategy was very much a kind of dog whistle, as they say, using rhetoric to appeal to conservative whites, especially in the South. And Trump did something very similar to that. So there are quite potent similarities. I mean, I think the Nixon analogy is far more apt than the Andrew Jackson analogy. The one thing about Nixon, I'd say, is you know we associate Nixon with impeachment. We're going to talk about impeachment in a few minutes. And the kind of end of his career and the end of his presidency, that took a long time to unfold. I think one crucial difference between the early days of the Nixon administration and the early days of the Trump administration is the fact that things seem to be proceeding and deteriorating, if you will, at a very quick pace. Yeah. In 1969 and 70, Nixon seemed to be governing the country in a quite capable fashion, and he was surrounded by people who appeared to be very able, and you know, things, Watergate and the scandals that undid Nixon took a few years to manifest themselves. Trump seems beset by difficulties, usually of his own making, from the outset. We're only 7 weeks in, and it feels like we're 2 or 3 years in.
Yeah, I mean, the structure of their White Houses, though, seem similar in the sense that both Trump and Nixon like to surround themselves by men who think the same way they do, and you know, maybe Kissinger gave him some pushback on some things, but, you know, Bob Haldeman was, I think, largely, you know, agreed with Nixon whenever he could. And I think the other people in the White House didn't, you know, Colson and the like were fairly sycophantic in their treatment of Nixon.
Yeah, although in fairness, David, I think all presidents to some extent are surrounded by sycophants.
Yeah, well, that's...
And true believers and people who've been with them from the beginning. I mean, the interesting thing about Trump is he hasn't, you know, he didn't spend the past 30 years running for president the way many candidates do. And so he didn't have a group of true believers around him necessarily. But I don't think, I mean, you're right. Nixon was surrounded by true believers and sycophants, especially at the end. But I'm not so sure, you know, the friends of Bill, as the Clinton circle were called, would be all that different, really.
Oh, but I think, you know, Clinton had, you know, Madeleine Albright and other sort of, you know, career political types that weren't particularly, you know, in his pocket or, you know, wouldn't be afraid to disagree with him on things. But, you know, I think you're right. Everyone does have that sort of inner circle in the White House to one degree or another that are going to tell them what they want to hear. I think Nixon, you know, I think this happens to lots of people in the White House, but Nixon in particular spent a lot of his term, you know, 1.5 terms in office, isolated from the rest of the public. I think the ways in the, you know, the White House tends to have that effect on people where you tend to be cut off from, you know, political discourse or from, you know, the, you know, broader debate. And Nixon seems to have been, you know, sheltered in that way, in a similar way that Trump seems to be right now. Trump's not, for instance, especially after some tweets last weekend, not interacting with the press at all, and actually isolating a lot of his staff from the press. So I think that's an interesting, you know, similarity between the two.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It is interesting, speaking of last week's tweets, which really set off the Trump as Nixon comparisons.
Because Trump made the comparison.
Pardon?
Well, because Trump made the comparison, although in that case he was, you know.
That's right. I mean, last Saturday, and that seems like a lifetime ago, Trump tweeted early in the morning about how President Obama had allegedly tapped his phones, and he compared it to Watergate. Yeah, so Trump invoked Watergate, but of course he did so to attack his predecessor, former President Obama, which was a little bit of a interesting jujitsu, I suppose.
Yes.
His attempt to deflect these criticisms. So Trump himself seems aware of this. One thing that I read about this week is Trump actually has a letter from Nixon framed in the Oval Office.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this.
Yeah, Nixon apparently it's a letter that Nixon wrote to Trump decades ago, saying you've got a bright political future or something. So Trump isn't necessarily, well, he's using Nixon as a kind of weapon to attack President Obama. He's not entirely running away from this comparison, and that kind of reflects the rehabilitation of Nixon, I think, on the right in American politics. One thing I would say, and I do think we have to be a little cautious. I mean, the lawlessness of the Nixon White House was pretty profound at the end, and the kind of cynicism, especially with regard to foreign policy, and the frankly, tens and hundreds of thousands of people who died in Southeast Asia as a result of those policies. We have not yet seen that kind of misbehavior on the part of the Trump administration, and let's hope we don't.
Yeah, but we're only 51 days in, so...
Pardon?
We're only 51 days in, so it's...
Indeed. Yes, I mean, who knows what will unfold, and the past is prologue, but I think the Trump-Nixon analogy is more useful than the Trump-Jackson analogy, to be sure.
Yeah, if we have to make an analogy, I think that mine, there are parts of it that definitely work.
That's right. That's right. And it doesn't augur well because it didn't end well for Nixon or the country.
All right, so topic number two, this is actually in some ways connected to our discussion of Trump and Nixon. There have been lots of people, especially on Twitter and Facebook and other various places, talking about the possibility of impeachment. There have been two presidents who have actually been impeached but not removed from office, and one, Nixon, who would have been impeached and removed from office had he not resigned first. Frank, I know everyone knows or learned in middle school how impeachment works, but do you want to give the Cliff Notes version for those people who hadn't looked at Article 2 of the Constitution recently?
Sure. One thing to bear in mind is impeachment was also in the news this week because the president of South Korea was impeached.
Peach, yes.
South Korean Constitution was modeled in some ways on the U.S. Constitution. So impeachment is in the news. So impeachment is just a trial, actually. Mm. And the Constitution reserves the right to try certain political officials, particularly members of the judiciary and the executive branch, the president, for breaking the law and violating the Constitution. And so what happens is an impeachment is actually voted upon by the House of Representatives. So a majority of the House of Representatives would vote to impeach the president. This has happened, as you said, twice in the past, to Andrew Johnson in the aftermath of the Civil War and to Bill Clinton in the late 1990s. And what that is in kind of... in legal terms, it's the equivalent of an indictment. It's saying there are charges to answer. And then once an impeachment has been voted on, or articles of impeachment have been voted on, the case is actually tried before the Senate. And the Senate acts as the court in those circumstances. And two-thirds of the senators have to vote to impeach the president, to formally remove the president, according to the Constitution. So a president can be impeached if articles of impeachment are adopted by the House of Representatives, but he or she can only be removed from office if two-thirds of the Senate vote to convict effectively. So it's not a majority vote in the Senate, it's two-thirds. And as you suggested earlier, in the cases of Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, although they were impeached, that is, they were referred to the Senate for trial, they were not removed from office.
And I think people often conflate those two things and use the term impeached to mean removal from office when it's just the indictment.
That's right. That's right. And Richard Nixon, interestingly, was not impeached because he resigned in 1974 before he could be impeached. Now, I think he saw the handwriting on the wall and knew that he would have been impeached by the House of Representatives and convicted, I think, by the Senate. And to avoid that humiliation of being the only president to be kind of stripped of his office, Nixon resigned. He got out in front of it and resigned. He jumped before he was pushed.
All right. So I think... Sorry.
Could you say a bit about Andrew Johnson, I think, is a really interesting case because as the first case of impeachment, we talked about conviction in treason trials a few weeks ago. The first case is really, really important because it sets the precedent. So could you say a little bit about Andrew Johnson's impeachment?
Yeah, so Andrew Johnson, of course, became president in April of 1865 when President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson essentially was put on the ticket when Lincoln ran for re-election, in large part because he was the one Southern Democrat not to leave the Senate. He was from Tennessee, and so he's actually from a different party than Lincoln and a different party than most of Congress. They had a very lengthy fight between President Johnson and Congress over Reconstruction, so 1865, 1866, 1867 were very contentious political years with lots of fights over the Freedmen's Bureau and the 14th Amendment and various pieces of civil rights legislation. What he was actually accused of, there was the crime that he was impeached for, was the violation of the Tenure of Office Act. This was a law that Congress passed specifically to protect Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, probably the only person in the cabinet, I think, who was still a carryover from the Lincoln administration. And it what the Tenure of Office Act said basically was that somebody who was confirmed by the Senate couldn't be removed from office without also being their removal being confirmed by the Senate, essentially. Johnson tried to replace Stanton to get one of his own guys in. And when he did this, Congress, the House of Representatives, filed bills of impeachment for him for a violation of the Tenure of Office Act. Although really, sort of in practice, he was on trial for a whole number of malfeasances as president during the preceding couple of years. They have a trial in... he gets convicted by the House and moves over to the Senate. They have a trial. It comes very, very close to actually removing him, and they fall one short of the two-thirds majority needed for conviction. Afterwards, he goes back, and you know he had been causing problems, or at least from Congress's perspective, causing problems. You know, for the first two-thirds of his term in office. Afterwards, he basically stays in the White House and doesn't do much of anything except for drink excessively. And so in some ways, it had the needed, the wanted effect of making him stop interfering with congressional reconstruction. But that's as close as anybody has gotten to actually being removed from office by the procedure.
Now, in terms of that, David, when I think about the Johnson impeachment, I think it's a really important moment because as a constitutional democracy rather than a parliamentary democracy, the United States does not have anything equivalent to a vote of no confidence, which can happen, you know, in the UK, example, right? Most parliament, and usually a vote of no confidence is followed by the government falling. Had Johnson been removed from office for effectively political reasons, then it might have established a precedent within the American constitutional system that was not that is not unlike a vote of no confidence. But because Congress adhered to a fairly strict interpretation of the Constitution, it meant that this kind of path hasn't been taken to the same extent. Although, as you say, it was effectively the same as a vote of no confidence in terms of its impact on Johnson. But in thinking about the way impeachment has been used or not used subsequently, I think that precedent's really important. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Congress is very apprehensive about, or at least for most of American history, been very apprehensive about using this particular tool. I mean, I think, you know, a handful of judges have been impeached. But it's not a part, you know, a mechanism that gets very well, a whole lot of exercise. You know, the more recent example, of course, is Bill Clinton's impeachment, which, you know, both of us, I think, remember probably more detail than we want to. you know, and that struck me as a very different kind of phenomenon. I always think of Bill Clinton's impeachment as political theater. In large part because, you know, he got convicted by the House. The Republicans were controlled.
Well, indicted by the House.
He was indicted by the House, right, sorry. He was indicted by the House, but Republicans had control of the House during the Clinton impeachment. But there were enough Democrats in the Senate who understood that, you know, he hadn't, that his crimes were, you know, didn't reach the threshold of, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors laid out by the Constitution, that it was really, you know, a dead letter from the very beginning. I don't think there was any reasonable expectation that he would be removed from office, given simply the who was in power in Congress and the ways in which the structures worked and the necessity of having a two-thirds majority.
Right, all of which we're thinking about because about the current situation. There's a lot of talk about Trump's impeachment, again, at least on social media and among his critics. Mm-hmm. But as you've suggested, David, this is a political act as much as a legal one. And so what are the prerequisites for impeachment? I mean, I explained the kind of what the Constitution says has to happen. But, you know, politics is about what can be done. So what are the prerequisites for impeachment?
Well, I think that, you know, the prerequisites essentially, I think, is that the other party has to be in charge of Congress. I can't see a scenario in which, you know, a party is going to impeach their own president, a party from their own power, a person from their own party. In all three of the cases, in Johnson, in Nixon, and in Clinton, you know, the opposing party was in power in Congress at the time that the impeachment, or the would have been impeachment, his removal from office, happened. And I think that's what made that kind of mechanism possible. You know, you're not going to have the House going forward with an impeachment trial unless, you know, Trump claimed during the campaign he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't lose any credibility. I don't know whether that's true, but it seems like there's no serious critique of his presidency coming out of Republicans in Congress right now. And I can't see one coming. I think they would be politically shooting themselves in the foot if they did. So I mean, I think it's very unlikely that without, unless we have another intervening election, so in 2 years, I think there's a possibility of something happening, assuming that Trump continues in his current vein of governing. I can see something happening then if the Democrats regain control of the House and the Senate, but with the current political configuration, I can't see anything happening.
Right. I mean, I agree with you on that. We'd have to see the House shift to the Democrats in 2018. And even then, the prospect of two-thirds of senators voting against the Senate so evenly divided, two-thirds of the senators voting against Trump seems unlikely. However, I mean, here's where the Nixon case might be out. I mean, by 1974, Nixon had not only lost the Democrats in Congress, but he'd also lost the Republicans. And he knew that. He recognized that, which is why he resigned. Yeah. So it is possible. So if Trump, if Trump's actions and administration are as catastrophic as many people fear, that is possible. But I think you're right. It's not going to happen anytime. It can't happen before 2018, the 2018 election, and thus the inauguration of the new House in 2019. So it's not imminent.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's different with Congress today versus Congress in 1973, 1974, is there aren't any moderates in Congress anymore, really. Whereas I think the distinctions between the two parties in the early 1970s was much more blurry. You had conservative Democrats from the South, you know, who many of whom later became Republicans, but in 1973, 74, they were still Democrats. There were some liberal Republicans in Congress. And so, you know, the allegiance to party, I think, was less profound then than it is now, and less ideologically based than it is now. So I think he'd be very hard-pressed to find any Republicans who would switch sides and hurt the party today. Whereas I think in the 70s, that you know, middle ground existed.
Well, unless and until their own political interests are threatened.
Oh, to be sure.
So, so let's suppose, and we won't have time to talk about this week, but I'm sure we'll return to it subsequently. Let's suppose that the replacement for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which is already being dubbed Trump Care, was a real disaster, especially in places like Kentucky. Well, will Rand Paul, for example, suddenly rethink his slightly odd support for Donald Trump under such circumstances? Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a possible thing. That's, or, you know, he still hasn't been challenged by any scandal that wasn't of his own, any sort of crisis that wasn't of his own creating. So we haven't had a major foreign policy crisis. We haven't had a natural disaster. We haven't actually had things that require leadership in a time of crisis, other than, you know, misguided tweets or what have you. So we'll see how he deals with those. But that could also.
What do you think is the most likely thing that could lead to his impeachment?
Well, at the moment, I think it would be some kind of intervention or, you know, entanglement with Russia, both for him personally and for people who he associates with. That seemed, I mean, I don't know exactly what the details of it that will tip the scales on that one, but it seems like there's a lot there. There's at least a lot of smoke if there's not fire yet.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's the most likely and damaging. aspect of Trump's presidency so far.
The other potential, he doesn't seem to have a huge amount of respect for courts, and I could see him, a la Andrew Jackson, telling government agents to ignore a court order, and some people in Congress being upset about that, depending on what it was a court order about, but, that's just hypothesizing about things that he's likely to do, although he's unpredictable enough. I don't want to, gaze into a crystal ball too much.
That's right. Good.
All right. Topic number three. In an article in The New Yorker, Jelani Cobb recently wrote about Ben Carson, Betsy DeVos, and other Trump administration officials' understanding of history. This is an article entitled Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and the Misuse of American History. This was an article prompted in part by Ben Carson, the former presidential candidate and now head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, talking about slaves, the transatlantic slave trade as immigrants. Earlier, about a week ago, Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, talked about historically black colleges and universities as a pioneers of school choice. And what Jelani Cobb is arguing in this piece is this is sort of part of a bigger pattern within Republican circles and the Trump administration in particular. Frank, what did you think about this article?
I thought it was a great article, and I think it has a lot to say to us. I would say I think we do need to talk about DeVos and Carson, but I don't think this is unique necessarily to the Trump administration or only to Republicans. I mean, I think there's a tendency, and this is one of Cobb's points, which I find resonated with me, there's a tendency for all Americans to some extent, or many Americans, to adhere to a very optimistic interpretation of American history, and this leads to a sort of blurring and a tendency to downplay the more negative aspects of American history. And I think that's Cobb's larger point as well. And one of the examples he cited was also from the last week was the Washington Post referring to Sally Hemings as Thomas Jefferson's mistress, for example. And now there's a whole debate about how properly to describe the relationship between Jefferson and Hemings. We don't need to go into that here. But I think there is a tendency on the part of many people, even among our peers within the historical profession, to take a rather optimistic view of the American past, and even where things are the more negative aspects, to see them as kind of outliers, as exceptions, if you will. Again, that's more prominent. I've got to explain, much more common among the public, I think, than it is among historians. But I don't think it's unique to the Republicans or to the Trump administration. So that's one qualifier I would make. But one thing that struck me when I read it, and I think we'll link to the article on our page. One thing that struck me was I was thinking about Frederick Jackson Turner's essay from 1894. And for our listeners who aren't as well versed in American historiography as we are on these matters, Frederick Jackson Turner is the guy who articulated the frontier theory in American history and basically said that the American democracy and American political culture is a product of the settlement of the West and the frontier. And this has a great deal of resonance over the subsequent 130 years, or has had a great deal of resonance in many respects to this very day. But what's interesting about that is Turner basically says, in passing, the South doesn't matter. The South's an outlier because it doesn't fit his model. And to some extent, the tendency to dismiss slavery or to try to explain away the worst aspects of slavery, for example, is of a piece with this. And I think Ben Carson's comment or Betsy DeVos's comment about the aftermath of slavery reflect this tendency, which to some extent many people have kind of imbibed without even realizing it. Yeah. I think. What did you think?
I think you're right about, I think it's particularly true of Republicans that they want to create a past that is whitewashed, to put it mildly and to use that term in multiple senses. that, you know, if you want to make America great again, you have to have a past that you're looking back to. If you're a conservative, you're looking backwards in some senses to a idealized past. And that requires, I think, you know, historical amnesia about, well, lots of things, but especially race relations. I think you have to, you know, minimize slavery, you minimize the brutality of Jim Crow, you minimize, you know, all the sort of ways in which, you know, American history has been defined by, you know, racial violence as a as an organizing principle. One of the things that struck me about both Ben Carson and Betsy DeVos is I think they're both have been deeply embedded in the Christian education movement for the better part of the past decade. And there is a, you know, I think, an alternative sort of telling of American history that is very prevalent among Christian educators, and you see this in, you know, private Christian universities, but also in Christian homeschoolers and the like, where they have their own curriculums and their own sort of conceptions of the American past. And you see, I think, echoes of that in their comments over the past couple of weeks, this idea of labeling, you know, slaves as just another immigrant group.
Or workers,
right. There was a textbook a couple years ago that labeled them as workers, which is, you know, hugely problematic for all the obvious reasons. So I think within the kind of milieu in which they have been speaking and working, you know, for more than a decade before they, you know, took high government office, that's the kind of version of the past that their audiences were being familiar with. You know, so the curriculums created by Bob Jones University or Liberty University, I think, would actually fit in nicely with these kinds of formulations. So, you know, we hear this and the tone sounds, you know, ahistorical and you know, profoundly misguided. But I think within particular social circles, this is sort of the way they view the American past. The question I had about this, and Cobb doesn't really get into this issue too much, is the question about whether either Ben Carson, you know, or Betsy DeVos, you know that what they're saying is not historically accurate, and this is, you know, an intentional posturing of a particular kind, and why they're doing it, and I have no idea, but whether this is an intentional action or whether their understanding of American history really is this shallow and whitewashed. I was curious whether you had a thought on that.
I guess you're asking, does it matter? Do they know what they're saying, or have they just, or do they believe what they're saying?
Well, I think it does matter whether it's a, you know, if both Ben Carson and Betsy DeVos, you know, don't know any history, well, you know, that's, you know, they're in good company. There are lots of people who don't know their history very well, although most of them aren't secretaries of, you know, housing and urban development and secretaries of education. But
I think with Betsy DeVos's comments about historically black colleges being pioneers in school choice, you know, she's very committed to school choice, and she was speaking to a group of leaders from historically black colleges. So I think that was a fairly facile and simplistic comment that politicians make, pandering to a particular audience. Ben Carson's a little more interesting, I think. His comment about slaves, enslaved people as immigrants, is interesting to me because he stuck to it.
Yeah.
When, you know, in response to the kind of tweet storm and the real pushback he got on social media, he really kind of stuck to his guns on this. And I assume that Ben Carson, who is a highly educated man, is aware at some level of the history of slavery in the United States.
One would hope.
And yet, so I think he did know what he was saying in the sense that when he received pushback, he certainly stuck to his position. So I think there is a sense of a degree of intentionality behind his comments. Mm-hmm. Betsy DeVos, I'm less persuaded by, I guess, although she seems more rooted in that kind of right-wing Christian educational tradition that you've outlined. Yeah. So maybe I'm actually wrong about her. I guess. Well, I
don't think she has thought too much about historically black colleges and universities. You know, I think that maybe 5 minutes before that meeting happened, maybe the first time she thought seriously about their place in you know, American educational systems and their historical origins.
That's right.
So.
I mean, the one thing I'll say in closing, David, and I often say this to our students at Edinburgh, I find one aspect of this whole interpretation is this kind of myth of American innocence.
Mm.
And most recently we've been told, and this is a trope, again, of the left as well as the right, that America lost its innocence on 9/11 and the kind of subsequent rise the national security state and torture and everything else that followed on from 9/11 was a loss of innocence. I am mystified that anybody can believe that a nation founded on not one but two original sins, the displacement of indigenous people and their attempts at genocide, and the enslavement of and enslaved labor, could possibly believe that such a country could ever have been innocent.
Yeah.
You know, because these are two kind of foundational cornerstones of the American Republic. The United States has never been innocent. And countries aren't people. They're not virgins. And you can't reacquire your virginity.
Yeah.
So this trope always mystifies me. But it's very, very persistent. And it's premised on that optimism and that optimistic interpretation of the American past that Cobb is talking about.
Yeah. So speaking of that idea about countries as people, I mean, I often hear students when they're dealing with slavery, you know, in the antebellum period or earlier, you know, they say, well, it was a young country. They didn't know what they were doing. You know, that conception that, you know, the country wasn't very old, therefore we can sort of excuse its, you know, critical flaws, strikes me as just a, you know, worthless argument, but it's one that I think people often make. All right, we need some more, and on a happy note, Frank, what kind of last drops? Give me something good.
My last drop concerns a wonderful collection at the National Library of Scotland. And the National Library of Scotland is a fantastic institution, not far from our own campus and offices. And the National Library holds the papers of a woman named Henrietta Liston. And Henrietta Liston was the wife of a British diplomat, Robert Liston, who was for a brief time in the late 1790s, the British ambassador to the new United States. And Henrietta Liston's diaries and journals, which the National Library has just digitized and made available online, and there's a wonderful film describing them by our friend Dora Petherbridge from the National Library. Henrietta Liston's journals and diaries are wonderful because she does not have she does not exercise the discretion that her husband, who's a diplomat and a government official, has to do. She's a wonderful writer. She's an insightful commentator, and she's a bit of a snob, and she's grumpy. So her journals are wonderful. I commend you to have a look at them online at the National Library's website. And she gives a wonderful insight into what the United States was like in the 1790s. So just to give you one example, she comments in one of her entries, she says, you know, there's very little crime here. We can leave our door unlocked. But the people seem to make it their kind of national obsession to rip us off all the time. I'm using a contemporary vernacular. She doesn't say that. Put it in those terms. But she says, everyone's trying to cheat us all the time. So although they won't rob you, they will, you know, so because I'm the wife of a diplomat, they know, they think I have a lot of money to spend. They always raise their prices when I come into a shop. And so she finds it very, very frustrating. Aspects of living in the United States, very, very frustrating. She's wonderful. She's a wonderful commentator. She's an insightful social commentator. She's very entertaining to spend some time with. She is of her time. She has a blind spot where slavery is concerned, for example, but she's well worth your time to read.
All right.
Have a look at the list of papers on the National Library of Scotland's website.
Yeah, so I'll put a link to that and to the video that Dora made introducing the papers in the collection, which I saw the debut of, I guess on Wednesday. They had a lecture for International Women's Day. Catherine Algor from the Huntington Library gave a lecture, but they preceded it by showing I guess the trailer for the digital collection. So I'll post that on in the show notes. So my last drop, a week ago, we had the annual meeting of the Scottish Association for the Study of America, or SASA, which is our annual conference of Americanists, mostly historians, but also people who do literature and arts and other kinds of things. And it roams around different Scottish universities. But this year it was in Edinburgh, and so we were lucky enough to host it. We had the biggest SASA meeting ever. It's been going on, Frank, you may know this better than I do, about 20 years?
Yeah, about 20 years. Yeah, it was founded by our predecessor, Rhodri Jeffries-Jones.
Yes, and Rhodri, of course, was there as the president emeritus, but we had a really great international crowd, lots of people not only from around Scotland, but from England and Ireland and Wales, and actually from a bunch of people from the continent this year. One thing we didn't have was a whole lot of people from America, so what I'm hoping for is that future SASAs, we can get people to come over. March is actually a great time to come to Scotland because it's pretty cheap this time of year. You know, it's not high tourist season, so you can see lots of things without huge crowds, and the airfare isn't too bad. So I want to endorse SASA, and I also want to publicly thank two of our grad students who did 99% of the work organizing and putting together and making SASA successful, Catherine Bateson and Kristen Blackstone, who were both just went, you know, a mile beyond to make sure that everything ran smoothly. All right. Frank, until next time, cheers.
See you next week, David. Cheers.
For those of you still listening, I forgot to record the trailer at the end while we still had Frank online, so I will do it in his absence. Please follow us on Twitter. We're at Whiskey Rebel Pod. You can also find us on Facebook. If you're listening to us, you're probably listening to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Podbean. We'd really like people to leave some reviews on iTunes. It helps people find the show. So we're having a little contest in which Frank and I are both giving away autographed copies of our most recent books to randomly selected reviewers. We've had a handful of reviews since last week. We really appreciate those. But we can get some more reviews by the end of May. We will be giving away two autographed copies or one autographed copy for each of our new books. So go to iTunes, leave a review now. Hopefully we'll see you all next week.